I'm going to talk tonight about Hall Laurie Calhoun, the Christian scholar. And the co-editor of that volume, Dr. J.E. Choate, is present tonight and led our prayer. I may not do it in the manner in which he would, and he may not do it the manner in which I do, but I hope to cover the waterfront as he knows it. I want to recognize also Dr. Peter Morgan here on my left, who is president of the Disciples of Christ Historical Society. He has just come aboard after Dr. Jim Seal retired. I heard him two Sundays ago in a lecture at the Christian Church in Frankfort, a congregation that originally was established by Philip Slater Fall as the Church of Jesus Christ. It's now a Christian church, Disciples of Christ. And he did a most magnificent and a most marvelous job in biographying Walter Scott. And I'm delighted that he thought well enough of us tonight to come. Also, John Bobby Hall and Frieda are present tonight. John Bob and Frieda have been under our coattail and attached to our apron strings and within our bosom for a long, long time, and I'm delighted that they're here. Clarence Hopper has been one of the most faithful attendants at this meeting. He and I were in school at Fried Hardeman in 1928 and 29 and 30. Clarence is a little older than I am. He was a year ahead of me in college. He was accelerated academically, but retarded. He was accelerated chronologically, retarded a little academically. And I caught up with him in college. But Clarence has been a dear person to us, and I am delighted that he's here. But I do want to spend our time tonight, however much of it you can endure, talking about Hall Laurie Calhoun. This is the last book I have. I brought a number of them down. I didn't think you were that concerned about them. And you've bought them all up, but I have one left. And that's the only one that I do have left. But I may offer it to the highest bidder, because J.E. is here, and he and I both can sign it, and that'll be a plus to you, and you would bid highly for it. Brother Paul Tucker sent me a newspaper clipping about the last child of Hall Laurie Calhoun, who has recently died. Dorothea C. Elder died on July 26, 1996, at the age of 86 years. She had a sister named Margaret, and she and Dr. Choate and I interviewed both of them in writing our book, as well as interviewing one of his grandsons. So really, I suppose, the immediate family of Calhoun has all gone. Dr. Choate said he attended the memorial for her. Now, the name Hall Laurie Calhoun was given to him by his parents, John Shelton Calhoun, and his mother, Louisa Hall Calhoun, as a family name. It's the name of his mother, who was a Hall. The Laurie part of it came in because the physician who attended him at his birth was named Dr. Laurie. So they took the family name Hall and the name Laurie and put them together and named him Hall Laurie Calhoun. Fascinating character that he was. Private individual in all respects. Highly complex in all that he did or thought or said. And we have said concerning him that he touched every base in the Restoration Movement. He was with every group that was known along the way, coming in and going out, and he touched all of the bases. Now, Dr. Choate and I collaborated in writing this book. I've never claimed the major share of it, and I haven't heard that he did. If he does, I'll deny that he did. But we did literally collaborate. It took us 4 years to collect all of the material and put it together and get the Gospel Advocate Company to publish it. We said in our publication that he was the protege of John William McGarvey, and indeed he was. John William McGarvey had greater influence upon him, I think, than all of the other individuals combined with whom he came in contact. And we have styled the book The Christian Scholar, because a scholar Hall Laurie Calhoun was indeed. I became interested in reading and writing about Calhoun after I retired from the presidency of Morehead State University in 1977 and moved back to Lexington. We found ourselves right in the center of gravity of the Restoration Movement. And most of the literature originated among the writers in that area. I had access to the library at the University of Kentucky, at Transylvania University, at the Lexington Theological Seminary, and the Lexington Public Library. And they were rich in material concerning the Restoration Movement and all of the individuals involved with it. I really, in the beginning, was motivated to research McGarvey at a level that I don't think anybody has researched McGarvey. And I still don't think that individuals have presented McGarvey in the fashion in which, if you said, will the real John William McGarvey stand up, that he would stand up today or even during his lifetime. He was a great scholar indeed. He was a dedicated teacher indeed. He was a marvelous writer and wrote commentaries, particularly on the book of Acts, that have never been surpassed. But everywhere I turned in this research, I found Hall Laurie Calhoun cropping up. Well, it was just piecemeal, a little here and a little there. Some had said something about him that's good, and some said something about him that was not very commendable. And this quickened my interest in him, because I remembered that in 1928, as a second quarter freshman at Freed-Hardeman College, the church in Puryear, Tennessee, invited me to come and sing for a revival meeting, lead the singing for it. And they had invited Hall Calhoun to do the preaching. That was my first introduction to him. I found him to be one of the most excellent Bible scholars, among the most tremendous preachers and pulpit orators that I had ever heard. I had learned soon after I met him and during the meeting that he held a PhD degree from Harvard. I'd never seen a fella. I'd never heard a man. I'd never been in the company of an individual who held a PhD degree, let alone from the Divinity School in Harvard. I was fascinated with that, because I started at Old Panhandle School with a teacher who had just graduated from high school. I'd never had teachers that held those degrees. Wasn't anybody on the faculty of Freed-Hardeman College who held a doctor's degree at that time. I was fascinated with it. So I got up enough courage one time to ask Dr. Calhoun what subject he used in writing his dissertation. Now, I don't think I'd do that today to anybody. But I was a brash college freshman, and I was inquisitive and insensitive, and I said, tell me what you wrote your dissertation on. Dr. Calhoun said, why, son, if I told you, you wouldn't understand. And if you don't believe that takes the wind out of your sails and the puffiness out of your ego, you just let somebody talk to you that way. But it also incited me to say, well, old boy, some of these days I'm going to find out what you did write it on. And I think then I'll understand and know what you did. Well, Dr. Schulte and I contacted Harvard University, where his thesis is still on file, and learned that the subject of it was the remains of the old Latin Transylvania of Leviticus. And he took the Jerome Vulgate, which Jerome had translated into Latin, and he reversed the translation of that back to English and wrote a critique of the old Latin translation of Leviticus. Well, I couldn't do that. I'm not sure I could even read it today as he translated it, but I thought he should have dealt with me a little more gently in talking about it. I later heard him preach on WLAC from the auditorium of the old Christian, or the old Central Church of Christ here in Nashville. He preached there during the last 10 years of his life and was heard all over the region that constituted the outreaches of old WLAC. It is said that every radio, or a radio in every business place in all of the West Tennessee town, would be turned to his noon broadcast. And you could walk down the street in any of these communities and go from store to store and not miss a sentence that he uttered. He was an outstanding, and I heard him in West Kentucky. Then I visited one of his services at the Central Church at the noonday hour one time when my brother Basil and I and two other people were going to Chattanooga to hear Foy E. Wallace and Charles, on premillennialism. We went over there and we stopped to hear Dr. Calhoun here in the auditorium. We went on over and heard Charles Neal and Foy Wallace debate the question of premillennialism. And as the result of my cursory survey of Hall Calhoun, the director of the lectureship at Freed Hardeman asked me to prepare a lecture for the lectureship at Freed Hardeman. Well, I have known Dr. Choate all of his life, I guess. He grew up in Wingo, where we spent 10 years teaching school. And he remembers that when the old Water Valley High School burned, that they transferred the faculty up to Wingo, and he was one of the teachers in the Water Valley School. They transferred him up as a teacher in Wingo, and we taught together. He testifies to the fact that the first sermon he preached was at Old Knob Creek, and that I got the brethren to invite him to preach his first sermon. And the first meeting he held was out at Old Macedonia, out from Mayfield, and I asked the brethren to invite J.E. for the meeting. I do not place as much importance on that as he does, but it indicates the relationship we've had over a long time, and I felt free to write J.E. and say, I wish — he was teaching at David Lipscomb University then — I said, I wish you would get some of your advanced students to do some research in the library and in the Historical Society and in the Gospel Advocate files about Calhoun. Well, he was kind enough to consent to do so, but he didn't spend very much time until he said, I don't want the senior students to do this. I want to do it myself. And I want to propose to you that we collaborate in writing his biography, because I'm just finding bits and pieces and parcels, and we ought to put it together and try to put Hall Laurie Calhoun in his proper perspective and present him as he really is. Now, we found early that when Hall Calhoun left the Christian church that they literally vilified him. They just dropped him like a hotcake. They had nothing to do with him and nothing good to say about him in their writings about him. But you turn the coin and the Church of Christ deified him. He did no wrong. He saw no evil. He heard no evil. He spoke no evil. And they put him up on this pedestal, and he was entitled to be put up, but not as high as some of them did. So somewhere between the reaction of the Christian church people and the Church of Christ people, J.E. and I tried to find out who he was and place him in that proper perspective. But he was not very well known by his family. His children didn't know him very well. His grandsons do not know him very well. And so it was a difficult thing, as you would know, to ferret him out. Why would you call Hall Laurie Calhoun a scholar? Well, Calhoun was born in Conyersville, Tennessee. And he was reared in that rural agricultural community. His first training was in the Conyersville Male Female Academy. And he went to school there until, I guess, he was about the sixth grade or something. Then his parents transferred him to Mayfield, Kentucky, and enrolled him in the Mayfield Seminary. And we think it maybe was a middle school, like we call them today, or a junior high school. Now, his brother-in-law, W.T. Shelton, and his sister, who had married Shelton, Mattie, were living in Mayfield, and he was preaching for the Restored Church in Mayfield at the time. He spent 2 years in Mayfield from 1777 till 1779, and then Shelton and his sister moved to Union City, Tennessee, and so Calhoun went to Union City to go to high school. And he stayed in Union City for 4 years and graduated from high school. And then they talked him into staying 2 years and teaching in the high school after he had graduated. So he stayed there from 1879 till 1885. Then he went back to Conyersville after that to prepare for an appointment he had to West Point Military Academy. He had to pass an examination, and he spent this period of time preparing himself to pass that examination. But right on the eve of the date on which he was to report to the military academy in New York, his father called to him and said, "Son, I don't want you to go in the military. You don't want to be a soldier. We do not want you to make a career of the army. You've always wanted to preach. And I'm going to make arrangements somehow to send you to the College of the Bible in Lexington, Kentucky, to sit at the feet of John William McGarvey." Well, I'm sure the joy and ecstasy was beyond explanation, but he, in 1888, enrolled in the College of the Bible as a part of Old Kentucky University in Lexington. Now, Old Kentucky University was a successor to Old Bacon College. Now, Bacon College was founded in Georgetown, Kentucky in 1836. And Walter Scott was the first president of Old Bacon College. Then it moved later to Harrodsburg. And then in 1865, it moved back to Lexington and became a part of Transylvania University, which had remained dormant for a number of years. Well, the old College of the Bible was established by McGarvey in 1865 as a part of the Kentucky University, and that's where Calhoun went. He earned his baccalaureate degree in Kentucky University and his classical diploma from the College of the Bible. College of the Bible didn't issue degrees then. as it does now as a theological seminary. So he earned his academic degree from Kentucky University and his classical diploma from the College of the Bible. After he graduated in 1892, they asked him to remain and teach in the preparatory school. They had some sort of an arrangement with the preparatory school. When people could not qualify for admission to Kentucky University, they'd put them in this secondary level training for a while. And he taught in that school for a couple of years before he returned with a new wife to Conyersville, he said, to take care of his aging parents. In 1987, the old Georgie Robertson Christian College was built in Henderson, Tennessee. J.H. Robertson, who was a wealthy farmer in West Tennessee, said that he'd give $5,000 if they would raise $5,000 and build old Georgie Robertson Christian College and name it after his daughter, who had died soon before this time. They did. And they invited Calhoun to deliver the address when it was dedicated. And he became acquainted with A.G. Freed and the other people down there. And they invited him in 1900 to return to Henderson and join the faculty of old Georgie Robertson Christian College. A.G. Freed and E.C. MacDougall were the co-presidents of it at that time. McGarvey was sort of lying in wait to see how Calhoun developed academically. So in 1901, McGarvey invited him to return to the College of the Bible to teach. He received that letter with ecstasy. We don't know the letter that McGarvey wrote him, but we do know the reply that Calhoun made to McGarvey. And he was just highly elated that he could return to the College of the Bible. When he did return, he found that McGarvey wanted him to advance his academic training and earn advanced degrees, and he'd set up an arrangement for him to go to Yale Divinity School. So he took his wife and what family he had and struck out to Yale to go to school. They arranged for him to draw, I think, $50 a month, wasn't it, J.E., they paid him $50 a month while he was in school, under the promise that he would return to the College of the Bible when he had finished. After he'd spent 1 year in Yale, he had met the requirements for a Bachelor of Divinity degree. Now, I checked at the Lexington Theological Seminary, see how long it took a person to earn a baccalaureate degree in divinity, and they said 3 years. He earned it in one. Then after he was there for a year, he said he had learned all that they had to offer, all that they could teach him. They couldn't give him any more. So he wanted to go to Harvard. The dean of the school in Harvard tried to talk him out of coming, but he was so set on going that he refused to be deterred. So they admitted him at the Divinity School in Harvard, and in 3 years, he earned a master's degree and a PhD. Now here he earned a baccalaureate degree at Kentucky University, a Bachelor of Divinity degree at Yale, a master's degree at Harvard, and a PhD degree at Harvard. We're not begging the question when we say that Hall Laurie Calhoun was a scholar, and a scholar indeed that he was. Now, after he spent his 3 years at Harvard, he went back to Lexington to join the faculty of the College of the Bible in 1904. And we found, and we've recorded in our book some of the reaction, glowing reports of this young man and the upcoming scholar of the Restoration Movement in Lexington. And they received him with open arms. Now he served for a period of time as a professor in the Bible College, and then later he became dean of the college. And then when McGarvey died, he was selected as acting president for a while. Now you trace that, and if you don't conclude that Hall Laurie Calhoun was one of the most outstanding scholars in the brotherhood of that day, and I don't know many, except J.E. and me, who have touched him since. Great, great scholar that he was. Now let me look a little at his early life and his early religious experiences, because that's more important to you than the historical aspects of it. Calhoun was born on December 11, 1863, at a little community in Henry County, Tennessee, named Conyersville. It was located in Civil District number 14. Now, this is the county to which my ancestors came from North Carolina and settled, not in this magisterial district, but in that county. And so we have had some attachments to that area, as well as our regard for Calhoun's people coming to live there. His parents, John Shelton and Martha Lou Isa Calhoun, had come to Henry County from North Carolina by the way of Wilson County and Davidson County in Tennessee in 1848. When Calhoun was 12 years old, he attended a revival at the little Methodist church in this community, only institution that was there at the time of a religious nature. His father arranged the farm work so that he could go and attend this meeting. Well, he went intent on getting religion. That was his intent. And so he went in the morning service and he went at the night service. He joined his peers at the mourner's bench. They admonished him, they prayed over him, they sang over him. But he said that he never could get any different feeling after he went than he had before he went. But all around him, his peers were rising up and said, "We've got it. We've been prayed through. We've got religion." But he never could get it. So he finally decided that he was looking for something that he had gotten and didn't know he had it. So he just announced that I've got religion. But he always doubted. It never did satisfy him. He never was pleased with it. He went home that day with his mother, with his older sister Mary, and told her about his doubts. And she said, "Well, now don't worry about it. That's typical of people. When you first are converted and when you are first saved, you have doubts and fears and anxieties about it. It'll all pass." But his brother James, who was studying medicine at Electric College in Cincinnati, Ohio, was going through the same kind of experience. And Hall Laurie knew that when James came home for the summer, that James would have all of the answers. But James said, "I'm going through the same kind of experience. Now, I can't give you an answer at all." Well, he labored under that impression for 2 years until he went to Mayfield. And when he went to Mayfield, during the time, first year that he was there, a gospel meeting was being held in Mayfield. And Calhoun went to this gospel meeting for 42 nights. And after he had heard 42 sermons, he said he went forward at the invitation, confessed his faith in Jesus Christ, announced that he had repented of his sins and that he wanted to be buried with the Lord by baptism into death. And either his brother-in-law or somebody else took him and baptized him. Now, writing about that 70 years later, Calhoun said that he never regretted doing that. Now, between the time that Calhoun had gotten religion in Conyersville and the time that he went to Mayfield, W.T. Shelton, his brother-in-law, went to Conyersville to hold a meeting in this Methodist church. On the first night of his meeting, Calhoun's mother came forth and made the confession and was baptized. Sometimes later, Calhoun's father was baptized. And this shook Calhoun from the very foundation of his religious conviction. And he announced in a clear, firm voice, "The Camelites are not going to get me." And he didn't think they were. He thought he was going to stay with what he had, and he was not going with his father and mother, but he later was baptized. Now, when Calhoun graduated from the College of the Bible, he returned to Conyersville. Here now he has a baccalaureate degree and a classical diploma, pretty well fixed, to teach school and to preach and to move among the brethren in West Tennessee, which he did. He taught in the old seminary there in Conyersville and went out on his own to preach. And he was in great demand. Great success have been recorded of the meetings that he held. But he went over to the 10th Street Church in Paducah, Kentucky, to hold a meeting. At the close of the meeting in which he preached, the church asked him to come and be the regular full-time preacher. Though he lived in Conyersville, he and his wife commuted by train from Conyersville to Paducah, and he preached for a year in Paducah. Now, the church in Paducah was a society organ church. You know, during that period of time, Dr. Peter, they talked about organ and society churches and non-organ and non-society churches. But the church in Paducah was an organ society church. And the way it got its organ, and it was visited upon them by a man named J.K. Burton, a Bondurant. I'm getting my Burtons and Bondurants mixed up here, as you all know. But J.K. Bondurant was a wealthy grocer, and he furnished the money to build the building and exercise his prerogative to put an organ in there because he liked instrumental music, he said, in the worship of the church, and so he put one in. Calhoun opposed it. Very vehemently he opposed it. And somebody said, "Well, why didn't you successfully oppose it?" Well, he said, "I decided that if I opposed the organ and divided the church, that I would be guilty of dividing and division, and I didn't want to do it. I thought it's better to use the organ than to divide the church." Well, you said, "Isn't that rather faulty reasoning?" Well, I think so. But I heard a preacher in Nashville, Tennessee, a few years ago, speaking from the platform of the auditorium in Fried Hardeman University, say that if the brethren where he preaches were to introduce an organ, that he would not mount the pulpit and oppose it. So we have Calhouns among us today who reason and argue in the same sort of fashion. But he stayed there a year, and then he moved over here to Franklin, Tennessee, south of you, and preach for a non-organ, non-society church. Now, we decided that Calhoun could play it either way. He could be for it or against it. Whichever way the brethren wanted to do it, he acquiesced in the matter. Reminds me of the story that I have told, and you have too, about the young teacher that went to apply to the local trustee of a public school for a job. And the trustee asked the young teacher, "Do you teach the world round or square?" And he said, "Sir, I'm prepared to teach it either way." And he wanted the job so badly. Now, whether Calhoun wanted the job so badly that he decided he could teach it or preach it or practice it, either way, he went here to Franklin and stayed until 1900 there. Now, let me turn to him in an area that we were quite impressed with, Calhoun in religious conflict. Now, you can imagine a fellow like this would find himself in deep and intense conflict with ideas, with issues, with himself, with individuals, and all of these kinds of things with he came in contact. Edward Orman Hale wrote his thesis for a Bachelor of Divinity degree at the Lexington Theological Seminary in 1978 on the subject, A Man in Controversy, Hall Laurie Calhoun. Well, we did not think that Calhoun was so much a man of controversy as he was a man of conflict. And I believe we presented him in the light of the conflicts in which he engaged rather than just the controversy. Now, the Apostle Paul engaged in a great controversy on Mars Hill, but it was not the kind of conflict in which Calhoun found himself. Now, so great were his conflicts that William Clayton Bowers, who was a party in this period of the history of the College of the Bible, told me that Calhoun had a split personality. He was schizophrenic. And he said that the reason he was a split personality, a schizophrenic, because he was caught in a bind between the conservative position of the Church of Christ in Tennessee and the liberalism to which he was exposed in Yale and Harvard. I don't believe that at all. I don't think the record shows that. This was Bowers' estimate of him. We found letters that Calhoun had written back to McGarvey, and he said, I'm under these influences, and liberal are these views, contrary to what I have learned and different to what you taught me. But he said, I'm not being influenced by them. He said, it is different to be exposed to them to meet the legal academic requirements of degree and in accepting those ideas as your own. So he studied liberalism at these theological seminaries or divinity schools in view of meeting the requirements for graduation and not accepting the ideas as his own. And in these letters, he would say to McGarvey, the more I'm exposed to the liberalism of the divinity schools at Yale and Harvard, the more precious the grand old gospel appears to me. He said, it means more to me now than it did when I was exposed to it. And he went through it. So I don't think he was a schizophrenic at all. But he knew where he stood with regard to the teachings of the Bible and the speculations. And I can understand why William Clayton Bowers said this. Because William Clayton Bowers was an educational sociologist. He was not a Bible student. Roscoe Pearson, who was a dear friend of mine, and the former librarian at the Lexington Theological Seminary, told me one time that William Clayton Powell didn't have enough religion to fill a thimble. Well, a fellow that doesn't have any more religion than it takes to put in a thimble wouldn't be able to define the way of a fellow like Hall Laurie Calhoun. But he was in conflict with these ideas and in conflict with the people who held those ideas and in conflict with the issues that had arisen as the result of them. Now, Calhoun had not been exposed, really, to the question of the American Missionary Society or the instrumental music in worship until he went to Lexington. He was baptized in Western Kentucky. His parents were baptized in Western Kentucky. When his parents were baptized, they took membership in the Old Blood River Church of Christ. And then later, James A. Harding went to Conyersville and established a congregation of the Church of Christ. He had been influenced by that until he went to Lexington. But the year he arrived in Lexington, the old Main Street Church had just introduced an organ. I've read that story and it's fascinating. When they introduced an organ at the old Main Street Church, there was so much opposition to it and so much dissension over offering it that they got a little cottage organ and hid it behind the curtain on the stage so nobody could see it. They could hear it, and they thought not seeing it would not insult them as greatly as if they saw and heard it. But this is his first introduction to an organ in the worship. Well, instead of going to old Main Street, he went to Broadway, a congregation that John William McGarvey had established in 1870. Because the Main Street had become so large and the quarters could not accommodate them, some of them broke off and established the old Broadway church. Well, that's where McGarvey went. And it was there that he met Mary Etta Stacy, whom he said came down the aisle one day to join the Bible class that he was teaching. And he announced to himself then and there, I'm going to marry that girl, and did quarter and pressed his suit and married Mary Etta Stacy. So he stayed at Broadway while he was there, and McGarvey stayed at Broadway during this period of time. In fact of the business, McGarvey stayed with the old Broadway church until 1903. In 1903, the Broadway church introduced instrumental music into its worship, and McGarvey left and went to Chestnut Street, a Christian church that did not use instrumental music in its worship. During the time that Calhoun was in Lexington, he preached at the old Providence Church. Now, that's located about halfway between Lexington and Nicholasville. You passed it there, A.T., when you would travel up and down that land. It's a congregation that originally was established by Jacob Kreft Sr. as a Baptist church. And John Allen Gaynor converted Jacob Kreft to the truth, and they changed from a Baptist church to a restored Church of the Bible. So he preached there. And in 1910, they got up a petition in the community. Everybody signed the petition for Providence to introduce an organ in the worship. Mrs. Alma Browning, whose father was an elder in the old Providence Church at that time, lived in the condominium where we lived in Lexington one time. And I asked Ms. Browning about this, and I read the minutes of the old church and all of that. And I said, Ms. Browning, do you remember the time that the organ was introduced in the Providence Church? Well, she was 96 years old at that time, and I was younger than I am now. And she said, well, young man, I reckon I do. I played it. And I said, well, what did Calhoun say about it? She said, I don't remember a thing in the world that he said in opposition to putting the organ into the old Providence Church. But she said, I do remember that old Brother Mars was an elder. And that on Sunday morning, after they had introduced the organ, that they called on Mars to wait on the table, Lord's table. And when he got up to the Lord's table, instead of talking about what he went up there to do, he delivered a discourse in opposition to the organ. And instead of officiating, he just walked out of the building and went to Chestnut Street where McGarvey was. Aren't these conflicts? Isn't he laboring to establish his faith and his position and his convictions in all of the things that were happening at that time? Now, while Calhoun was preaching in Paducah and in Franklin during the period between 1896 and 1900, David Lipscomb and James A. Harding invited him to come over to Nashville here and be interviewed for a position on the faculty of the old Nashville Bible College or Bible School. But he came, anxious to teach, anxious to show forth his wares as an academician. So he came. They talked for about 4 days, as I remember. And finally, Lipscomb, Harding said to him, now, we'll give you a job, and we can get you a preaching assignment at Fayetteville, Tennessee. And you can live in Nashville, and you can teach at Fayetteville. But they said to him, if you come, you're going to have to renounce your affiliation with the Christian church and with John William McGarvey. Well, he said, I'll do no such thing. He said, I consider John William McGarvey as good a Christian as you all are, and I'll not do it. And then he turned to Lipscomb and said, why, Mr. Lipscomb, you preach among Oregon churches, just like I preach among Oregon churches. And Lipscomb said, yes, I know, but you stay too long. Well, I don't know how long a fellow would have to stay not to adopt it, but this was his explanation of it. Well, they would not give him the job except on these conditions. He refused them, and he went to Georgia Robertson Christian College and taught there for a year. Now, when he went to Georgia Robertson Christian College, he found that the college was affiliated with the Tennessee Missionary Society. In fact, they owned it. And that the church in Henderson used the organ in their worship. Here now are A.G. Freed and E.C. MacDougall and N.B. Hardiman and L.L. Briggins, all members of the faculty of the old Georgia Robertson Christian College, using the organ in the church and teaching in a school affiliated with the Missionary Society. Well, Calhoun felt perfectly at home. He was just like a rabbit thrown into a bar patch. This is what he had decided that he would do. Because when Calhoun went to Lexington to teach in the College of the Bible, we say that he crossed his Rubicon. He cast his lot with the Christian church and with McGarvey and the College of the Bible. And here now he's come to Henderson and he finds the same thing down there. You know, I enrolled in Henderson in 1928 as a freshman. And nobody on that campus ever told me that college one time, as Georgie Robertson Christian College, was affiliated with the Missionary Society, or that the church used an organ in its worship. Not one of them. I never heard of it until I read this story. And J.E. and I ferreted this out and found Calhoun's situation in that kind of environment to which he went. But really, at this point in time, when Calhoun left Henderson after a year and went to the College of the Bible in 1901, he not only crossed his Rubicon, but he really began an ascension, a rise, and he rose to the very heights of the organization and the hierarchy and the leadership within the Christian church in Kentucky. And it's amazing how rapidly he did rise in the affairs of the Christian church at that time. But I must pause to remind some of you, and I think I appreciate John William McGarvey as much as anybody does. I've used his writings, I've read his writings as much as anybody. I think he was the man of the book. W.C. Moreau wrote Brother McGarvey and did an excellent job in certain areas. But McGarvey never did identify with the Church of Christ. He was always identified with the Christian church. And consequently, Calhoun identified with McGarvey and the Christian church in Lexington and wherever he went. Now, this brought him in to what finally arose in 1917 as one of the greatest conflicts within the Restoration Movement, certainly within the academic community of the College of the Bible. And Calhoun found himself in conflict with all of the rest of the forces in that institution, even the board of directors itself. Now, McGarvey had literally been grooming Calhoun to succeed him as the president. He had his mantle ready to put on him, just like Elijah placed the mantle upon Elisha as his successor. And he'd worked at the job of preparing him and training him He'd been his mentor and his protege all of this time. But McGarvey died about this time and left Calhoun to paddle his own canoe. W.C. Morrow came to the College of the Bible as a professor of Greek and Christian doctrine in 1906. He later was promoted to the deanship. He resigned that in early 1911 and went to Butler University, and that left the deanship open. McGarvey recommended, and the Board of Trustees elected Calhoun as the dean to succeed Morrow. McGarvey died in October of 1911, and Calhoun was named acting president of the College of the Bible. R.H. Crossfield, one of the most liberal within the ranks of the Christian church at that time, had come to the College of the Bible, or had come to Lexington, as president of Old Transylvania University. And he had served since 1908, during this period that we're talking about, leading up to the death of McGarvey. He had served as president of Transylvania University. Now remember that in October of 1911, McGarvey had died. Isaiah Boone Grubbs had retired. Robert Graham was dead. Moses Easterly Lard had died. And Professor Jefferson had fallen dead with a heart attack. Well, that left only Calhoun as one of the old guards in the College of the Bible. He was the only one that taught like McGarvey taught. Only one that taught what McGarvey taught. Only one required of the students what McGarvey had required of them. And here Calhoun had learned to do it, just like McGarvey had done. But he stood alone. I thought of Isaiah, don't you? Well, he was literally standing alone. At this point in time, Crossfield instigated a proceedings that finally resulted in his becoming president of both Transylvania University and the College of the Bible. I think, and J.E. agreed with it, and he thought, and I agreed with him, that he was rather cunning in what he did. He announced to the trustees that he was going to leave the presidency of Transylvania University and go back to the pulpit and go back to preaching. But he said to the Board of Trustees, "You ought to select a man as my successor who will be both president of Transylvania University and the College of the Bible." Well, they said that's a good idea. We could reduce some conflicts as the result of that, because there'd been serious conflict between McGarvey and John Bowman, and even between Calhoun and Crossfield. Said we can reduce them, and we'll do that. But then they looked around and said, "Dr. Crosswaite, how about you taking the job?" "Oh," he said, "I thought you'd never ask me." Kind of an attitude, you know. "I'm ready for it. I think it ought to be done, and I'll be willing to do it." So they elected Crossfield as the president of Transylvania University and the College of the Bible at the same time. Well, this was the green light for Crossfield to move in the direction that he wanted to take Transylvania and the College of the Bible. He immediately set about to replace these individuals whom I've named with people of his own leanings. And he named first Alonzo Willard Fortune, and secondly William Clayton Bower. And I knew both of them quite well. We have known the physician, son of Fortune. We've known his daughter, who married an outstanding political leader in Kentucky. William Clayton Bower served as a member of my doctoral committee when I defended my dissertation at the University of Kentucky. So I looked on him with great respect and with great regard. He had just returned from the University of Chicago to do some work in Kentucky, and he served as chairman of my committee. The other two were George W. Hembry, who really was of non-entity. He didn't raise his voice or bat his eye about any of these things. And the brother-in-law of Clayton Bowers, Elmer E. Snoddy. And Snoddy was an outstanding scholar, an outstanding teacher, but one of the most radical among the four new teachers that he had selected. Now, I interviewed Bowers when he was 102 years old for our book to find out what he still thought about Calhoun. And he still thought he had a split personality and schizophrenic. I attended his funeral when he was buried at the age of 104 years. So he had a distinguished career, as you can see in there. Now, what happened at the College of the Bible in 1917, we call in chapter 7 of our book a firestorm in the bluegrass. And be it known to all of you, it was a firestorm. Wasn't confined merely to the bluegrass either, because it swept throughout the brotherhood, and individuals from afar were influenced by what was going on. On March 12, 1917, Benjamin Franklin Battenfield and a group of mature Bible students in the College of the Bible wrote and mailed letters to 300 preachers among the disciples to ask them to protect the college against destructive criticism in the classroom. And these letters went everywhere, aroused all kind of discussion, all kind of opposition to the College of the Bible, and gave vent to many individuals who had previously supported it. Now, the basis of their contention was that these teachers were all destructive critics. And they charged Bauer with saying that Jehovah was the tribal God of Israel, and that he thought the Pithecanthropus erectus is the missing link between man and lower animals. Well, you know, later, the old Pithecanthropus erectus was found to be fraud, but he thought it was the missing link. They said that he taught that. Snoddy said, "I am a hard evolutionist." He said, "The first chapter of Genesis is but poetry." Now, when we started our research, I went to the Transylvania Library to find out about this controversy and conflict and all. They didn't know what it was talking about. And the librarian finally said, "Oh, you're talking about the period of the teaching of evolution." Yes. And so she had all of this file under a file of evolution, because that was the main thrust of their indictment against this faculty of at that time. And the same thing was brought as indictment against Fortune. They said Fortune taught that men who wrote the New Testament were not inspired, but their writings were. Well, that created a difficult thing to understand. Fortune said, I believe in theistic evolution. Fortune denied the physical resurrection of the body of Christ. Now, that was the situation as the picture was in 1970. I've just skipped over it. But then Crossfield mounted a counter-offensive, or a counter-effort to offset this information that had been disseminated. So it brewed on and brewed on for a while, until finally the Board of Trustees decided to have a hearing on this subject. So the curators were called together and held their first meeting on May 1, 1917. And they met to investigate the charges that Battenfield and the others had filed against him. They held 15 sessions. And after the 15 sessions were over, And I have read, and J.E. has read, the hearings that they had at that time. Bowers rose in the middle of the hearing and said, you all are conducting a heresy trial. And Bowers contended it was a heresy trial until his death and said, I'm not going to have anything to do with a heresy trial. That's like old Connecticut with witchcraft, and I'm not going to do it. Well, finally, they made a report. And I think, and you read it for yourself sometime, I think it was the most boss report that any group of intelligent and responsible men could file regarding such an important and critical issue as was raised in the midst of that situation. They structured the hearing, they intimidated the witnesses, they threatened the students in every shape, form, and fashion. But finally, they filed a report. And the report said that the hearing had been completed. And I style it a whitewash. They literally whitewashed everything that had been taught. They said that the faculty and president were exonerated from all of the charges. They have just been teaching in the tradition, in the style of the movement, and they have not deviated one whit from it. Now, the chairman was Mark Collis, who was the minister of the old Broadway church at the time. And he voted for the report to exonerate the faculty, but with reservations. And he said, I want to see this thing out. And I voted for it, but I reserve the right to oppose it later. Well, they didn't give him a chance to change his mind. They changed his position. And the next year, they voted him out as the chairman after 25 years as chairman of the College of the Bible. Now, we do not claim that this is the only answer.